Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm talking to a couple of people. One of them is responsible for a brand new publishing house, the Indigo Press, which is an independent publisher of fiction and creative non-fiction. It brings together a conversation-starting curation of books that offer bold ideas and beautifully crafted stories. And the second is the author of one of those stories, the first in the Indigo Press Mood Indigo essay series, in which leading international writers offer personal reflections on the pressing social and political issues of our time. Well, today we speak to a Zimbabwean author in the week that the country goes to the polls. She reflects on the coup that was not a coup, the telling of history and manipulation of time, and the ancestral spirits of two women, her own grandmother and Mbuya Nahanda, the grandmother of the nation. Welcome to the author of These Bones Will Rise Again, Panache Chigamutsi, and author, critic, writer and broadcaster, Ella Wakatama-Awfrey. Thank you both for coming.
Thank you.
Ella, I'd like to start with you and have a chat about this momentous achievement, setting up a publishing house. It's a huge deal. So the banner on your website of the Indigo Press reads, "A person's spirit is their cloth." What does that mean?
A person's spirit is in their cloth. When we were looking for a name for the press, we knew it had to start with an I because the business is built with four different businesses. There's the Marsh Agency, there's Live Lit, and there is the Dulwich Bookshop. It's called Mild, and so the I was missing. And I knew I wanted something that sort of indicated strength and internationalism. I thought first I'd find it in a Greek goddess, but every time I looked up a Greek goddess with an I in her name, it was just a bit problematic. They all did things that I didn't quite want the publishing house to embody. And then I read Catherine McKinnon's book about indigo, the cloth and the dye, and it was really fascinating to me that this is a cloth that has this really ancient history. You find indigo remnants in Peru, across the African continent, in Europe. And so there's a very sort of ancient history of indigo itself, the dye. And also the idea that it was before cotton, indigo was what slaves were used to manufacture, I guess, to grow and manufacture. So there's that history of sort of enslavement of African peoples. But then African women traders in West Africa who were trading in indigo made lots of money. It was a source of emancipation. And they used some of those funds to fund independence movements. So there's a history of oppression, but also liberation and travel. And it seemed to me that all of those things embodied the kind of publishing that I wanted to do, publishing that was very, very local, but with a global impact.
Well, let's examine your particular cloth. Let's unravel it, as it were. So I think, first of all, full disclosure, you are my oldest and dearest friend. Let's just get that out the way. So in terms of your upbringing, obviously, we're both Zimbabwean. We grew up there. But then you went off to university in America and then you started work in publishing here in Britain. Tell us about that career trajectory.
I was a very late comer to publishing. I tried lots of other things. For the longest time, I thought I wanted to be a management consultant. The only problem is that in England, you start off in that career as an accountant. And if you can't count, there's a slight problem there.
So as somebody that went to school with you, I can absolutely say that's true.
It's absolutely true. I remember doing my O-level maths and I failed. I got a D and I was adamant that I didn't fail things. So I did it again and I got an E and then had to accept that maybe my talents lay elsewhere. So in my 30s, I realized that I hadn't ever been happy in a job. It was my daughter and her dad who said that I should maybe, since I spent all my life reading and all my money on books, I should try and make that work. And it was your brother, Peter Godwin, who introduced me to his publisher. And she told me to just get a temp job. So I did. I temped for a whole year. And I remember walking into the offices at Penguin. They were then in Wright's Lane in Kensington. And there were books all over the floor and this sort of warren of hallways and people with piles of paper next to them and everything smelled of books. And it was this astonishing homecoming. It was the first time I'd walked into an office and I thought, this is my tribe. Crazily, there was no one else who looked like me there, but they were still my people. And so I guess from then on, I set about claiming my place in the tribe.
And you've done it enormously successfully. You went on to work for Jonathan Cape and you edited some really big names, people like Desmond Morris there. Then you went to Granter as deputy editor.
That was a wonderful move. I really love my job at Cape. I was both a desk editor and a commissioning editor, which meant that I got to work right across the list, bringing in new writers, but also being the person in charge of commas and full stops for wonderful, well-established writers. The move to Granter was to the magazine. It was a magazine that I had always loved and still do. And it gave me the chance both to build up a team that actually made this wonderful thing, you know, 3 to 4 times a year, and also to buy books for Granter. And it was probably the best career move.
It's something that you've been recognised for. You were given an OBE.
Yes, the strange thing with an OBE, especially in my profession, well, the wonderful thing first is that your peers nominate you and support your nomination. And so there's a recognition there that I was really humbled by. But at the same time, you then spend the rest of your life trying to be worthy of it.
I think you've done that very well, though, that you're involved in a number of very prestigious literary boards.
For around 7 years, I was on the board of the Writers' Centre Norwich. It's now called the National Centre for Writing, and helped see through capital growth that has culminated just 2 weeks ago in a wonderful building in Norwich at Dragon Hall and a centre for writing that I think is going to have a huge impact on our cultural life here. And I also am advisor on the Art for Amnesty board, which is wonderful. And also the Kane Prize for African Writing, the Nine Mobile Prize in Nigeria, which is a prize for new novels. And I'm a selector for the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio program. I have to mention the Royal Literary Fund because that's bringing me much joy at this point in my life. All of these things are work that you do for free, but actually the enrichment you get and how it then informs your own professional life is really important.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you were a judge on the Booker Prize.
Yes, I was a judge on the Man Booker Prize the year Marlon James won. That almost killed me. I now say when I speak about it that it was one of the best experiences of my life and I would never, ever do it again.
So with all of this, this incredibly busy life going on, all of these, lot of them not-for-profit jobs on the sideline, you suddenly decide to jack in your full-time job, go freelance, and then to open your own publishing house.
I spent about 3 years freelancing. I was told that I had to call it a portfolio career. I am really passionate about teaching editors on the continent. I think that, building up the creative industries is only going to come about by supporting the people who make the books, not only the writers. And had spent a lot of time developing that program and delivering that program. I also did a bit of writing myself, and my agent was Susie Nicklin of the Marsh Agency, who is a long-standing dear friend, as well as somebody whose own career I respect deeply. And we went out to lunch last June, and she asked me what my dream was, and I rambled about lots of different things. And I asked her the question back, and she said she was going to open a publishing house. And I said, what books will you publish? And she said, I don't know. What books do you want to publish? And the conversation went on from there. So the idea really is Susie's. And we worked together and announced the Indigo Press in October last year. It's very hard work.
How do you go about setting up a publishing house? Because, I mean, there are so many of them, and many of them are absolutely huge. Penguin Random House basically rules the world. So as a small independent press, it's not an easy landscape.
It's not. And the setting up was crazy. The summer before, I had been a visiting professor at Goshen College in Indiana, and the class I taught was an introduction to publishing, in which I had my group of 10 students set up their own publishing house. So on paper, it was all there. And obviously, I have lots of experience. I've worked for both Penguin and Random House, as you said. I knew how to do it. In the doing of it, it becomes an entirely different thing. I don't think that either of us has faced anything that we didn't anticipate. The time it takes to do all of the admin is incredible. My sister-in-law phoned me and I was on the way to Manchester and I said I couldn't see her because I had to fly to New York the next week. And she said, oh my God, your life is so glamorous. And I said, no, I've spent the last 2 days in my pajamas figuring out libel insurance. And so I think that's the thing with a small publishing house is that you have to do everything. But at the same time, the vision is yours. Susie and I are very clear about the kind of books that we wanted to publish. And you're right, there are lots of publishing houses out there. And so you really have to be clear about your editorial vision, to be really strategic about it, because why should the book buyers and the bookshops be looking at your books instead of somebody else's? You don't want to be doing what everyone else is doing. And so that vision is very, very, very important.
And one of the things you have, one of your USPs, if you like, is your wonderful essay series, the Mood Indigo series. Tell us about that and then why you chose this fantastic book that we're going to talk about in a moment, These Bones Will Rise Again.
My experience at Granta was a wonderful one. I was deputy editor to John Freeman, who now has his own literary journal, which is really worth reading. We were in a position where we could offer writers a substantial amount of money to go off to research and write a piece of long-form creative nonfiction. I loved working on those stories. I loved commissioning those stories. It was something that I missed very much, and I wanted to find a way to do that, but in even longer format. So instead of 10,000 words, inviting someone to write 20 or 25,000 words. I also knew that I was very curious about a range of current political and social issues. I didn't want a newspaper, and I didn't want a journalist to write it for me. I wanted novelists and poets to think about these issues and then to give me their thoughts, something that would get to not just the blood and guts of a matter, but to the heart and soul of a matter. And so that's where the Mood Indigo series came up. And so we had that right from the beginning. And last November, Susie and I were talking through our first commissions, and she said, we should do a book on Zimbabwe. And immediately that made sense to me. There were all kinds of things going on in our country at the time, and we weren't sure what was going to happen. It took me 2 seconds to know which writer I wanted. I had met Panache the year before at Africa Writes, the Royal African Society's festival, and knew of her work and had read her novel. And although I hadn't seen her do this kind of long-form nonfiction, I liked her brain and felt quite sure that she could do it. And also, I'm an experienced editor. I can guide a writer through something as long as they have the idea and the determination to do so. And so we invited her to do that.
How closely do you then work with your writers? Because it isn't just correcting grammar, is it?
No, it's not, especially when you're commissioning something. It's presenting them with the idea and then giving them some time to think about it. And this is the case with These Bones Will Rise Again, but also with our commissioning at Granta. The writer then comes back with their ideas, and it's really about the conversation. It's talking them through, asking questions, prodding, but also knowing enough of their body of work to be able to assess where their strengths are going to lie. For me, the key is to push them even further, is to be the one person who believes enough and is confident enough in their abilities to really push them to the limits of their ambition.
Well, this book has certainly achieved that. It's a wonderful book. It's called These Bones Will Rise Again, which are the infamous words of Mboya Nahanda, who's the spirit medium who lived in Zimbabwe and some say still lives. It's by Panache Chigumanzi, who's in the studio with us. Panache, it's so great to have you here.
Thank you for having
and
me.
Apart from our nationality, we share one thing, which is that we were born in the same hospital. I think what's really interesting about this is that when I was born there, it was called the Lady Chancellor. And when you were born, it was called the Mboya Nahanda.
Yes.
And in that sentence encompasses really the history of our country.
Yeah, definitely. I think one of the things that I speak to in this book is this concept of being a born free, which is something that's very specific to Southern Africa. So this idea of after independence, you're almost rid of the past, and these children who are born then are free of the past and can just look to the future. And this is something that is thrust upon young people both in South Africa and Zimbabwe, both of the countries that have shaped me in many ways because I grew up in South Africa. And so Mboya Nahanda, she was just someone whose name was always in my head because my mother had the maternity cards from Mboya Nahanda Hospital or maternity ward. And I didn't really know what the history was. And I think like many Zimbabweans at times, we just know this name of this woman who's probably the most famous person in Zimbabwe's liberation history. And it took many years before I would really begin to probe who is this woman. Of course, I know she means a lot in Zimbabwe's revolutionary history, the history of our various anti-colonial wars, and particularly the first Chimurenga, as we call it, and then the second Chimurenga in the 1970s or 1960s, if you want to go as far back as that. And for the last couple of years, I've been doing this research on this figure and thinking a lot about Zimbabwe and what liberation means to us. And so by the time Operation Restore Legacy, which is also supposedly restoration of the liberation legacy. This is what the military gives the code name to their coup, not a coup, as Operation Restore Legacy. It was an opportunity to then reflect on what does liberation mean and what has it meant, whether it was the state-sanctioned version of liberation or what does it mean personally and what has it meant for various women in Zimbabwe and particularly my grandmother who just passed a few weeks before the coup, not a coup, happened.
So let's just recap on a bit of history. So the country was formerly a British colony.
Yes.
In 1978, the independence process started following the Civil War, I guess people in other countries would know it as. 1980 brought independence and Robert Mugabe then came to power. He stayed in power until November 2017 when Operation Restore Order happened and that, as you so rightly say, we all call the coup not a coup.
Yes.
This is because the government was very keen to show that it wasn't a coup for a number of reasons. If it had been a coup, the African Union would have had to have got involved. It would have become a much more complicated issue. This way, Mugabe could be removed and Emmerson Mnangagwa, with whom he had fallen out, formerly his security minister, also a minister of defence at one time, could come back in. He's been ushered in. Now, we're having this conversation just before the elections. And this is the first time for many Zimbabweans that Robert Mugabe will not be on the bill. It's quite astounding for all of us, isn't it? How do you feel?
You know, there's a lot. A part of me, of course, you want to be very hopeful and optimistic. I find myself, it's cautious optimism because for a long time I've always been very adamant that there's an entire Zimbabwe outside of Mugabe. Very often people do not know how to talk about Zimbabwe outside of this one figure. And that's something even in this book, it was a very fine line in this tension of, you know, the impetus for this book was Mugabe's ouster, but I really was interested in talking about a whole range of other people because I believe that the country has so much more and he's very much a product of the best and worst of us as Zimbabweans, whether it is the love for education, whether it is his very brilliant Queen's English, and as well as his very brilliant Zezulu. People don't talk about the fact that he's a brilliant orator in Shona as well. There's a whole lot that is encapsulated in him. But what I'm most interested in is how then do we begin to think of a future outside Mugabe? The results of the election for me are less important than how the elections play out and what we do post the elections. And I think it's just, it's not going to, I don't think we're going to find as much change as we're hoping for in the elections themselves, but in the years that are going to follow. So I think for me, that's more where my hope lies in, is in the years that come, because I think very often if we look at the opposition, if we look at ZANU-PF, much of the current culture that created someone like Mugabe is very apparent in the ways in which they do things. And so that is what sort of gives me the caution that, you know, we kind of have lesser evils in some ways we have to choose on the ballot box. And importantly, very often what we find in Zimbabwean politics is that you have a mismatch of vision, integrity, and political traction. So you'll have many candidates who are very awe-inspiring, they have experience, they're technocrats, you know, that kind of thing. But people say, meaning that person doesn't have people, they don't have political traction. So this is the sort of almost catch-22 that we have at the moment.
A lot of that political traction, though, is bound up with having been an active participant in the War of Liberation. Now, just to go back to Mboya Nahanda, because, of course, she is the one that really has been present through all of the wars in spirit form. Perhaps you could just explain how that works.
So Mbuya Nahanda is a spirit medium. Well, at least the Mbuya Nahanda that we know, the Mbuya Nahanda who gives the name to the hospital that we were both born in, was a spirit medium who existed in the late 19th century. But Mbuya Nahanda is the name of the spirit. The spirit medium is then referred to by the name of the spirit. Her name was Chadwe. The spirit of Mbuya Nahanda in various different oral traditions has existed in some traditions from the beginning of what Shona people consider the beginning of time. And this spirit has been invoked in many periods, but the one who's most iconic has been the one who existed in the 1890s and fought in the first Chimurenga, what we consider the first anti-colonial uprising in Zimbabwe.
In 1896
to 1897.
Yeah.
And so she was a spirit medium and a spiritual leader, along with another figure who's also quite famous in Zimbabwean liberation history, was Sekuru Kaguvi, and he was also a spirit medium of the spirit Kaguvi. This is the concept of spirit possession, a person who then inhabits the spirit of a particular ancestor, and this is to do with traditional belief system, which believes in ancestor veneration. So you'll have a familial ancestor, which is a Mudzimu, and then you also have a national or broader spirit, and that we'd call a Mwonjuru. So someone like Nehande is a Mwonjuru. And so in the second Chimurenga, her spirit was then called upon. The phrase, "these bones will rise again," is very iconic because in the first Chimurenga, this spirit medium was captured by the British and she was then executed along with Kaguvi. But her famous dying words were, "my bones will rise again." And so that has been an inspiration for the liberation movement in then taking up the armed struggle again. You know, the spirit of Nehanda who died while talking, that's what people will speak about. And in the second Chimurenga, we also had another spirit medium who was possessed by the spirit of Nehanda. And many other spirit mediums were very instrumental in gaining the popular support of the liberation war. So initially we had the comrades in the nationalist movement who'd go out and sort of perform a lot of isolated attacks of sabotage against the Rhodesian state. And of course, they were thwarted and it didn't work out. So they decided they had to go back to the drawing board and thought, we need to give this war to the people. And the way in which to do that was to then get the support of the spirit mediums and the spiritual leaders. And really, that's getting the support of the ancestors to lead people in the present in a war for the future. And I think this is something that's really important to me, is a sense of timelessness. It's a rebuttal to this idea of born free, that you should be free of the past. It's to say that the past is very important in the now. The future is all important. So all these different temporal states, and I would think of it as decolonizing time, that we always have to be cognizant of the past, be cognizant of the present, and be cognizant of the future. And all of those states, we need to be cognizant of that. And, you know, one of the philosophies that's often very misused and often gentrified in South Africa is that of Ubuntu. And people speak of the concept of a person as a person through others. And so if we think about time as people today are there who they are because of the others who've been there before them, because of those who are here in this moment and those who will be there in the future. And I think that's an important metaphor for me in thinking about liberation and what freedom and democracy might mean in Zimbabwe, but across the whole world.
Mm. Mboya, of course, means grandmother.
Yes.
And your own grandmother,
yes,
features largely in this book. It's a wonderful personal journey of exploration, as well as an historical and national one.
Yes. A few weeks before the coup, not a coup, happened, my grandmother had passed away, my paternal grandmother, Mboya Lillian Chigumadze. And it was not the first time I've lost someone, but it really represented a deep sense of loss for me because there's so many questions and conversations I wanted to have with her about her personal history and the history of her outside of being my grandmother. You know, so this then was an opportunity for me to explore some of those questions. And I decided, well, you know, I don't have her there to answer those questions for me. I'm going to have to use my imagination and think, you know. And of course, it wasn't just my imagination. I went to go speak to her family. I went to the places she grew up and, of course, consulted history books to try and reconstruct the world that she was living in, what it would mean for me to have lived in her time. And this is then a response to, again, in ZANU-PF deciding that, or the military deciding that this is Operation Restore History, this or Restore Legacy. It was a restoration of a particular kind of history, a state-sanctioned history. Some historians in Zimbabwe call that patriotic history. That's the state-sanctioned version. I was then interested in what is my personal version of Zimbabwe's history, and this is through my grandmother. And in finding and understanding that, I also began to also understand the time in which the nationalist movement would have been forming in Zimbabwe.
So we're having this conversation before the election. Mm-hmm. We don't obviously know the result, although we're Zimbabwean, we're pragmatists, we do know the result.
You don't take power to give up power, that's all I would say.
So what's your vision of the future?
If I could choose, I think my vision of the future is when we begin to look at politics beyond people, beyond personalities. And again, where what we had with ZANU-PF is that there was such an emphasis on the past in a way to discredit any talk of the present struggles that you had. You could not talk about anything right now because, of course, we had a liberation struggle and we can't talk about anything else. And then you have, you know, the opposition movement who then can only talk about the future and does not want to talk about the past either. And so, again, I think we do ourselves a discredit when we're not always aware of the things that we've gone through. So in that, it's then taking cognizance of many of the historical injustices of the past. And this is right from colonialism and pre-colonial eras, as well as post-independence traumas. So looking squarely in the face of Gukurahundi, which is a massacre of more than 20,000 Ndebele people by the Zimbabwe Defence Forces.
Masterminded by the
president,
who's probably now been voted president.
Yeah. Exactly, the man who's now called soft as wool. And I think it's important to have that sense of accountability. Peace without justice is not peace at all. So I think it's important that in as much as we want to be very forward-looking, you know, right now on Twitter, there's circulating pictures of spaghetti junctions, because spaghetti junctions being those big infrastructural feats of, well, at least in Zimbabweans' minds, it become that kind of symbol of what Zimbabwe has failed in achieving, because we thought we would be this giant of Africa. And I think there's a place to have those dreams, to move into the future, but we also need to be very cognizant of many of these wounds of the past, because they continue to destabilize or continue to undermine the kind of future that we're going to have. So I think really for me, it's to have a political space where it's no longer focused on individual personalities, but rather on the people, which can be very flowery, but I do mean that, and a space that is always cognizant of all the different states of time, whether it's the past, present, and the future.
And just to focus on an individual for a moment, what's next for you?
What's next for me? I'm very boring right now. I'm about to start my PhD. I'm going to be doing that at Harvard. I'm going to be in African and African American studies, in comparative literature, and I might just do it in philosophy, so we'll see. And I continue to write as a contributor to many platforms, and we'll see. I think I feel like I've just given birth, so I don't really know much.
Well, right now. Let's talk to your midwife.
Yes. I have described her as that many times.
Ella Wakatama Orfri, of course, you are responsible for bringing this book into the world. And we stand now with an uncertain future for our country ahead of us. But I think that your vision for your own particular bit of real estate for the Indigo Press is very, very clear. What's coming?
I think that having Panache's book as our first is a really good sort of marker. It's the kind of mark that we wanted to make into the world. It's an announcement of what we intend to do. Panache has taken a big sweeping history of a nation and a people, as well as a very personal story, to illuminate an important issue of our time. And so that idea of global and local that we had set out to explore is really shown in this book. And the books that we're publishing going forth will do that. And you may not think so hearing about them. The next book we're publishing is in September by the American writer Ivy Pacoda. It's called Wonder Valley. It's a psychological thriller set in LA. And you wonder what the relation is. But Ivy's concerns, as well as being almost a genre writer, she's concerned with social inequality. Mm-hmm. Across the board. We then published Suleiman Adonia, who is an Eritrean Ethiopian writer, and his novel is an erotic novel inspired by Georges Bataille and Anais Nin. And you then say, well, how is that connected? But what Suleiman is looking at is the lives of people who live generation upon generation as displaced people in refugee camps. And he happens to be interested in how they view themselves as sexual beings, their relationships, the idea of identity, gender identity and power, and women's rights and the role of women in this very close, very intense society. And we continue to look for books that do that, that tell us different stories in different ways and are always beautifully written, but make you leave or end up, as I have done with Panache's book. I ended up feeling that I had been challenged myself and I'd learned a lot. And certainly my way of looking at the world and thinking and speaking of it has changed. And that's what I wanted to happen.
Ella Wakatama Orfri, editorial director of the Indigo Press, and Panache Chukwumadze, who is the author of These Bones Will Rise Again, part of the Mood Indigo essay series, also published by the Indigo Press, which I'm quite sure will go from strength to strength. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Many thanks to Helena Jarit and George McDonough. I'm Georgina Godwin. You can listen to this programme again and any number of shows from our archives on iTunes, SoundCloud, or indeed our own website. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.